Support for WPR comes from Stafford Rosenbaum, a Wisconsin-based law firm celebrating 145 years of commitment to practical legal solutions in areas such as family law and estate planning. StaffordLaw.com.
Support for WPR comes from Isthmus Partners, an independent asset management firm offering comprehensive financial planning and tailored investment solutions for clients nationwide. More at IsthmusPartnersLLC.com.
Think about space and the stars when I hear that music. We're talking about astronomy today. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Paul Kinzer in the studio with me is the author of Stargazing Basics. He's not really in the studio with me. He's on by phone, actually. Stargazing Basics, his book, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. He's a member of the La Crosse Area Astronomy Club. Also has a portable planetarium, and when he can, does shows all over the state when there isn't a pandemic. We'll talk with him about what you can see in the night sky at this time of the year and take your questions as well. So, what would you like to know about where the planets are this summer? And any questions about telescopes? What about books? Join the conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Paul Kinzer, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, it's good to be here. And boy, that music reminded me of being a little kid in front of the TV.
Isn't that great music? Yeah. I'm telling you. Yeah. I love that music. It takes you to another place, for sure.
Sure does, yep.
And some folks in Apollo were in a different place. There are a lot of important Apollo anniversaries coming up, or maybe some have passed, I think. Talk about them and what they mean to you.
Well, at the same time, I was a little kid. And, you know, when Star Trek was on, that's when the Apollo program was happening. And it was 50 years ago last summer that Neil Armstrong was the first to walk on the moon, but it's easy to forget that Apollo 50 years ago was still going on right around in January 1970 was, to me, one of the most amazing stories in human history. That was Apollo 13, and that was 50 years ago, just a couple of months ago. And Apollo 14 landed on the moon on February 5th, 71, and then 15 landed on July 30th, 1971, Apollo 16, April 20th, 1972, and the last one, Apollo 17, on December 11th, 1972. And I think a lot of us forget, even those of us who were alive at the time, that it was an ongoing mission. And they had actually planned several more missions, but those were all canceled. In fact, a lot of people after Apollo 11 said, "Why are we going back?" And you know, there was kind of good reason for that. It was a race, and we won, and why go on? Some people thought it costs a lot of money. But others said it's about science. It's about exploration. And now, in the next few years, we're probably going to be going back.
Yeah. Do you think that's going to happen?
Oh, I mean, in the next couple of weeks, they're going to send folks up to the International Space Station on the new capsule that may take people to the moon. And again, it's sort of a race, but this time it's kind of a race between some American companies. China says they're going there in the next couple of years, and this time there's real effort to possibly stay because they're talking about going to the poles where there's ice. We found ice there a few years ago, and if there's ice, you can stay longer. You can use ice, of course, for water, but you can also break it into oxygen and hydrogen for fuel and other things.
So that's going to be really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
To watch. You know, Donald in Bayfield County has a question that kind of relates. Let's go there. Donald, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. Say, on April 16th, about 9:30 p.m., I was outside, and I saw 28 satellites lined up in a row from the southwest to the east.
Yeah. And you're wondering what those were?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Correct.
Well, those are the Starlink satellites being sent up by one of the people who may create our next rocket to the moon, Elon Musk. And I'm going to express an opinion here. I do not like them. They are supposed to set up a very large grid of thousands of satellites in orbit around the Earth to give people internet access. They're going to be, when all is said and done, tens of thousands of them. And when they launch, or shortly after they launch, which they did at that time, they're quite close together. And, yes, you see them cross the sky together. But they're going to be up there, and they get in the way of astronomy, which is my passion. They will get in the way of imaging. They will get in the way of science. And we don't have any international agreements on how do you deal with that. And, in fact, there's another company, I believe, but I could be wrong, out of Britain, that is also planning on doing it. So they're going to be two competing, or maybe more than two competing companies, putting thousands of satellites in low Earth orbit. And Musk assured everyone when he started this program that they wouldn't reflect that much sunlight. And then that turned out to be wrong, but he's going ahead anyway. It's disappointing to me. Some people find it really cool to follow them. And, you know, that's okay, I guess. But I would rather follow the stars.
Well, speaking, thanks again, Donald. Appreciate the call. Speaking of the stars, what can we see in the night sky?
Well, right now, and in the next few months, I guess when I was really thinking about what's coming, the things that I thought of were, what are the things that are only going to be here maybe right now? And one of the first ones is a comet. And like it often happens, comets get a lot of hype. Comets are unlike other things in the night sky. They're very unpredictable. Once they find them, they can predict where they're going to be, but they cannot predict how bright they're going to be. There's a comet in the sky right now called Comet Swan. SWAN is an acronym for the Solar Wind Anisotropes Camera, whatever that is, at the Solar Observatory. And it was discovered by the satellite, I guess, but it was found by a person looking at images from the satellite. And people thought it was going to be a very bright comet, or that it might be. And when scientists say this could be a bright comet, that gets people hyped up. Ooh, it could be. That means it will be, and it'll be this bright. And it's turned out it's not that bright. Just in the last few days, it's gotten dim. The reason comets get bright is because as they come towards the sun basically melts them, and they're made out of various gases and ices, and they start to melt, and they give off light from the sunlight reflecting off those rising gases. Sometimes they give off a lot of gas. Other times they don't. This one was getting brighter and brighter, and now it's getting dimmer. Doesn't mean it won't get bright again in the next couple of weeks. It could get bright again. But as of right now, if you want to see it, you need to go out in the very early morning sky before the sun comes up, and you need to know just exactly where to look, and you need a pair of binoculars. So not so exciting. They had hope by now it would be a naked eye thing.
And well, then, you know, I'm just going to say I'm a little disappointed in my morning jogs. You know, this time of the year, it's not a good time. I'm even at 5:30, 5:45 in the morning, it's already light, and I can't see anything.
Yeah.
But what's going on that we can see?
Well, what we can see right now in the evening sky, maybe, is the planet Venus. It was high in our sky for the last couple of months in the evening. If you went out, you'd see this extremely bright star in the west. Well, that was the evening star, which is the planet Venus. It's closer to the sun than us, so it's always either in the west before sunset or the east before sunrise, because it's closer to the sun than us. It's always near the sun in our sky. And now, as it's getting closer to the Earth, it's getting lower and lower in the sky, you might not be able to see it. But in the next few weeks, then it will be rising before the sun. And then you'll be able to see it in the morning as the morning star. And if you stay up late right now, you can see the planet Jupiter first rising. And right now, Jupiter is arising. It's rising, around midnight. But as time goes on, it'll get earlier and earlier. A month from now, it'll be rising around 10. And then not long after it, Saturn comes up. And then not long after that, Mars comes up. So over the summer, we'll be able to see all three of those in the evening sky. By mid-July, Jupiter and Saturn will be up all night. So those are interesting things to see. And those are interesting things to look at through telescopes. But it's also interesting just to know, wow, I'm looking at a ball of rock and ice maybe a billion miles away. And if you have a small telescope and you look at Jupiter, you'll see its moons, even through binoculars. And you'll see it's the belts of gas on it. And if you look at Saturn through a small scope, you can see its rings.
Pretty cool.
So those are excellent. That is exciting. Yeah. You're right, though. It is getting dark later and later and light earlier and earlier. Summer is not the best time for astronomy unless you're up at midnight. But it's still a time that you can go out and look up.
I'm not always a fan of winter, but that's one of the fun parts about winter is the sky seems to be crisper.
Yes.
There's a lot going on in the sky in the winter.
Yeah, especially if you have kids, you know, in the winter you can go out right after supper and just look up. And there's the starry sky.
Tom in Green Bay has a question for you or a comment. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I recently was looking up some stuff on rocket engines, and there's a new engine that's coming out. It's called a plasma engine. One of the astronauts, Diaz Chang, is in the development of that. I was wondering if you're familiar with that, because the trip to Mars is supposed to be only like 40 days.
I missed the last part. It's what?
The trip to Mars would be only 40 days with that particular type of rocket engine.
Right. I'm not a rocket scientist. That's a fun thing to say. But I know there are many things that are under that have been long under investigation. I don't know much about a plasma rocket. I do know that there are various or ion engines. There are engines that continue firing, unlike the engines we use now that use a lot of fuel at the start, and they accelerate very, very, very high acceleration rates, and then they coast the rest of the way. That's why it takes so long to get there. But engines that can fire continuously, you know, you keep building up velocity, but then halfway there you have to turn around and start slowing down, or you'll zip right by the planet. Plasma engines are not something I know a lot about, so I can't really answer that. However, I know that this is an interesting historical thing. When I was really studying Apollo last year, while the Apollo program was going on 50 years ago, they developed a nuclear engine. In fact, the nuclear engine was originally going to be the third stage of Apollo, and they decided that it was not developed enough and safe enough. But then it was going to be used to go to Mars, and it would have gotten us to Mars much quicker than we can get now. But for political reasons and sound environmental reasons, they decided a nuclear engine wouldn't be the way to go. Would have been lighter, would have been able to fire longer. It wouldn't have had as high a thrust, but it would have had a thrust constantly. So I'm sorry I can't really answer about plasma.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for calling, Tom. Appreciate it very much. You can join in with your questions as well as we visit with Paul Kinzer, author of Star Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. Questions about the night sky, interested in getting a telescope, looking forward to an astronomical event, join in, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Turning our attention to the stars on this portion of the program, Larry Mueller with my guest Paul Kinzer, author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in recreational astronomy. He's a member of the La Crosse Area Astronomy Club. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. And Paul, we have another caller, Mike from Portage, online. Let's go there. Mike, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I just had a quick question. What would be a good beginner telescope?
Okay. There's one that I have been recommending lately. It's called the OneSky. Just one word. It's O-N-E-S-K-Y. It's put out by an organization. It's made by a company called Celestron, but it's they have a special program with a group called Astronomy Without Borders, and some of the proceeds from the telescope go to help folks in other nations, some of whom don't have the funding, get astronomy equipment. The thing is, it's a really nice telescope, and it's offered at a very low price. Now, you might not think $200 is a low price, but that's what it costs, but for that money, you get it's a reflector telescope that uses a mirror, and the mirror in this one is a little bigger than 5 inches across, which is a very nice size for a scope that size. It's very portable. It comes with eyepieces. I think that is an excellent, in fact, I think right now, the best buy for not just a beginner scope, but it might be all the scope you ever want. Look that one up, OneSky.
Mike, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in to 800-642-1234. Give a call. Many of us have been able to do some extra reading. Certainly have. Any books about astronomy that you'd like to recommend?
Yes, there's one that my wife, who's a children's librarian, she got this book for me. It's called Eclipse Chaser, Science in the Moon's Shadow. So if you have kids, and I would say, if they're great readers, third grade and up, but normal readers, I'd say middle school. It follows one scientist in the field. In fact, it's from a series of books called Scientists in the Field. And there's dozens of books in that series about all different kinds of scientists, and they're all very interesting because they get into specifics about what do they actually do. This one follows an astronomer who goes to eclipses, and I found it especially interesting for me because my son and I went to see in Oregon. We watched the total solar eclipse in 2017. Well, this follows her trip to Oregon, not right where we were, but quite close, in 2017, and all that she did. And it's told in this one is in a very suspenseful way. What's going to happen? Is it going to work? Because with eclipses, you never know. And it did work out for her. And just a very interesting read. Another one that's just come out that I haven't read yet, but I heard the author on Science Friday just last week. It's called Galileo and the Science Deniers by Mario Livio. He's a quite well-known writer. He's written many books, but he's also an astrophysicist. So he gets into not just the life of Galileo, which I find very interesting, but the conflict that he had with others. And it isn't just, you know, we hear about the later things with the church, but it wasn't just the church that he had trouble with. People at the time just looked at the world and the universe differently, and he was new, and he really faced a lot of criticism and a lot of uphill battles. So I am really looking forward to that. And then there are some others about Apollo. Again, last summer was the 50th anniversary, and with my portable planetarium, I went all around the state talking about landing on the moon, and I did a lot of research, and I read some great books. One of them is A Man on the Moon, The Voyages of the Apollo Astronauts by Andrew Chaikin. This is the book that the HBO series From the Earth to the Moon was based on. And it is a classic. It was written years ago, and at that time, the author, a very excellent reporter, he was able to interview almost all the folks involved in the Apollo program, and he follows the missions, and it's just fascinating. And then another one is... I'm sorry.
And the title of that one was, again?
A Man on the Moon.
Okay.
The Voyages of the Apollo Astronauts.
Mm-hmm. And then you had another one.
Yeah, Apollo 13. When it first came out, it was called Lost Moon, but its title now is Apollo 13. That is by Jim Lovell and Jeffrey Kluger. Jim Lovell was the commander of Apollo 13, so it's told from his perspective. And it's such a moving book. Again, I was 10 when it all happened, and I have a little story. Everyone in my class, you know, I was in fifth grade at the time, and my teacher even knew. Paul knows a lot about this stuff. And when it happened, my teacher asked me, in fact, said, Paul, they're going to be fine, right? And I almost burst into tears because I knew the chances were very small. I said, I don't know, and I don't think so. I think they're going to die. And she didn't like that. That's not what she was expecting. And so I was as thrilled as anyone when they made it. They made it, and they made it through a lot of hard work and a lot of clear, good thinking, and just such an amazing story.
Well, those are great. And you know what? We'll post those on our page. If you go to the Larry Mueller, WPR.org/Larry, and over in the notes section, over on the right-hand side, you'll see that. We'll put that list of the books that Paul's recommending. And we can also mention that we'll put that One Sky telescope. Maybe we can put that over there as well.
Sure.
Benito in Wisconsin Dells, it's your turn. Hi, thanks for calling.
Oh, yes. Hi, I was listening. You were saying that One Sky scope is a good beginner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yes, because I had a 6-inch Samsonian and reflector, and might want to maybe reemphasize people that they don't need like this monstrous scope. Something like that, you should be able to see easily. First, the moons of Jupiter, the Galilean moons, features on Jupiter, as well as distinctively in a good sky location, the features of the rings of Saturn, and as well. And I just kind of wanted to reemphasize that. Also, another good beginner is somewhere around a smaller refractor, such as a 60 millimeter, because a person can learn the sky that way with a low magnification.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
And I totally agree. It's certainly possible to spend a ton of money and get a big, giant telescope, but, you know, what I say to people is, and that's kind of what my book is about, a big part of it is how do you choose a telescope? If it's so big that you don't use it, you might as well not buy it. I mean, if you're not going to use it, why have it? And if it's easy to use, you'll use it more often, which is another reason I always recommend get a pair of binoculars. You know, most people already have them. Take them out. Look at the moon. Look at Jupiter. With Jupiter, you know, you can see the moons, the four moons of Jupiter, just with a pair of binoculars. You can see that Jupiter is a ball. And it's kind of amazing. It's 500 million miles away, but you can make out that it's a round ball because it's huge. 1,000 Earths could fit inside Jupiter if you could pour them into it. You don't need a large telescope. You need one that is interesting for you to use and that you can use. Yeah, yep.
Benito, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. Well, I'm sure that the coronavirus, COVID-19, has affected your own astronomical endeavors, Paul.
Yeah, unfortunately, this summer I will not be traveling with my planetarium. There is no way, unless they don't, you know, somebody booked me to only have 3 people in there at a time. It's usually pretty crowded in there. You know, we get 30 kids in there, and they're sitting close to each other, and we're looking in this inflatable dome that's 16 feet across. We're looking at the night sky during the day. So I just won't be doing that this summer, and that's the way it goes. We need to be safe. The thing is, though, that astronomy is just such an excellent thing to do while maintaining space. You can go out with a couple of people, just don't be right next to each other, and you know, maybe don't look through the same telescope. Often groups get together and they have telescopes of their own. And it's often something you do on your own. You're alone and you're out there and you can forget all about what's going on in the rest of the universe while you're looking out. Yeah, that's a great thing.
How have you been using that extra time? You're working on any other projects?
Oh, yeah. This is a word that I think, you know, it's interesting. I consider myself a maker. I, in fact, some of my astronomy people tease me a bit that it seems that I'm more into making things to use for astronomy than in actually looking at the sky. And I do make lots of things. I've made half a dozen telescopes. But even if you don't make telescopes, you can make ways to view them. You can improve the mount of your telescope. So I've been doing a lot of projects. I just finished repairing a telescope that wasn't working well. I stripped it all the way down to figure out why aren't these gears turning. Because one nice thing about a telescope, if you want to share it with groups, is to get one that's motorized so that as the Earth spins, as the Earth turns, the telescope follows that turning with a motor. And this particular telescope was not doing that. We call that tracking. So I took a couple of days to strip it all down, and it was interesting. It was a 40-year-old telescope mount, a very popular one from a company called Mead, and I figured out what made it tick, which was interesting, and I made it tick again, which was rewarding. So yeah, it's a good time to get out there and work on your equipment if you have equipment. Maybe even make some. There are loads of YouTube videos and books on do-it-yourself making of telescope mounts or even of making telescopes.
Tony and Amory emailed to ask what's going on with, is it Betelgeuse?
Betelgeuse, yeah.
Betelgeuse.
Betelgeuse, or in England they say Betelgeuse. Yeah, Betelgeuse is in, we probably can't see it anymore now. No, we can't. It's in the constellation Orion, which is one other wonderful thing about the winter sky. If you go out in the evening in winter, there sits Orion, the hunter, high in the southern sky, and it's a winter constellation. We can't see it now. It's in the sky during the day at this time of year. But Betelgeuse is Orion's left shoulder, and if you see it, it's a bright orange star. Most stars are white or blue, but it's orange, and Betelgeuse is about to blow up. And whenever I say that in the planetarium, kids, usually there's a gasp, oh my gosh. And in astronomy, about means in the next million years, it's going to blow up. But it could blow up tomorrow. We have no way of knowing. And what it did in the past year was something very odd. It's a variable star. It varies in how bright it is. And it varies over, there are some stars that vary in a very clockwork way. They go up, they go down in a very understood way. And then there are others like Betelgeuse that get brighter and then dimmer in a kind of randomish way. And what it's doing is it's swelling and then shrinking as it nears the end of its life. And this past year, it got dim very quickly compared to other times. So people were wondering, is something really strange happening? And we don't know. We just don't know. But that's why it was in the news. It was getting quite a bit dimmer. Not dimmer than it's ever been in the past, but it did it much more quickly than it's ever done in the past.
Mm-hmm. So what would we see if it, let's say, it blew up tonight?
Well, let's hope it doesn't happen now while it's in the sky during the day. That would be sad. We would really miss out. If it happened, my understanding, if you were sitting there, you know, you're outside and you're looking at Orion and Betelgeuse suddenly blew up, it would be very sudden. It would almost instantly become a very, very bright white. And it would get so bright that you'd be able to see it during the day. So I guess even if it blew up now, we'd be able to see it because we'd be able to see it during the day. And it would stay bright for weeks, and then it would slowly fade away, and then Orion wouldn't have a left shoulder anymore. And when it blew up, you know, kids worry about that. I mean, no, it's too far away to hurt us. It's hundreds of light years away. And if it blew up, we would be fine. And it's happened before. This is called a supernova. And stars have blown up in the sky before. There was one in 1054 that blew up, and we know that because Chinese scientists at the time, they wrote it down, and that that star that blew up is now known as the Crab Nebula. If you look up in the sky and you know just where to look, you see this fuzzy patch. That's where a star used to be that blew up 1,000 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It is.
Rod in Arlington has a question for you. Let's go there. Rod, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just kind of curious. I've seen a few other people using their phones, and apparently there are some apps out there that you can use and actually use your phone as a guide to tell you what you're looking at and to give you an idea where to start looking if you're looking for a specific planet or star or whatever. Have you got any app names that I can hopefully remember? I'm on the road right now.
Yeah, I'm going to leave this one to Larry. You have an app. I don't actually own a smartphone, so I know you have a program on yours, an app.
Yes, I do, and I'm trying to remember. I'm looking at it right now. It's Lite, L-I-T-E, I think it's called. I'm sorry. It's Star Tracker.
Okay.
And it's interesting because I have it out now, and I'm pointing it down, and so it's telling me what's on the other side of the Earth.
Yeah, isn't that fun?
It really is a lot of fun. Now I'm pointing it up, and it's amazing because it gives you the names of the various formations, stars, and so forth, and it's really a lot of fun. And sometimes when I'm out jogging or just walking around at night, and I see something, I simply point at it with my, I get the app out and point at it, and it tells me what I'm looking at.
There you go. And I know there are hundreds of astronomy apps for your phones. If you just did a search online for astronomy apps, there are those. The one you have is, people would call that a planetarium app. Another very popular one, I think for Apple, but I might be wrong, is Sky Safari. Just Sky Safari. And one that I use that you can get for your phone or your computer, and I have it on my computer, is called Stellarium. S-T-E-L-L-A-R-I-U-M. Stellar means star. Stellarium. And it's amazing. And it's free. This one is free. Some of them, there's a charge, but you can usually get versions that are either free or only a dollar or two. So, yeah, there's so many of them. And then there are other ones that aren't necessarily just to show you what's in the sky, but to teach you about telescopes or just so many things now. It's too many to name. But I'm still odd in that I don't own a smartphone.
Well, I'll tell you what, Star Tracker, I'm sure I've had it on for years.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure it was free, or maybe it was $1.
Right. Yeah.
Is
Star Tracker one word? Or is it
two? It was two words.
Okay.
I think it's two words. So there you go, Rod. That's my suggestion. I really have fun with it. It's a joy to have on your phone.
The interesting thing to me is probably 10 years ago, a couple of different companies came out with these specific devices that did that, and they wanted $300 for them. Sales dropped off rather quickly. Yeah.
Robert in Culver, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Robert.
Hi, guys. Thank you for the show. I think you almost answered my question there. I am looking for a computer, a small, 3 or 5 inch, and with the telescope.
Ah.
But it has a computer built into it that you can say Mars, and click, 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 boop, there's Mars, or there it takes you to Mars.
Right.
Do you have some names for me?
Well, I will tell you that you're going to get right up there in price right away, because for what you would spend on a computer that, or a telescope that does that, you could get a much larger telescope that doesn't. But if that's what you want, and a lot of people do, there are too many choices for me to go into. If you just go online and search for GOTO, G-O, sometimes people use just one word, G-O-T-O, or G-O-T-O, or the two words, telescope. That's what people call them. A GOTO telescope is a telescope that takes you to the target. The thing is with telescope companies, they change all the time. One of the big ones, Mead, just went bankrupt. It declared bankruptcy a couple of months ago. Yeah. And I could go into the whys and the wherefores, but yeah, it did. And it was one that did sell quite a few of those. And, you know, a few months ago, I would have said that. So if you just do a search for that, one company that is still around, Celestron, they sell them. A really nice company to go to for beginning telescopes or telescopes in general is Orion Binoculars and Telescopes. They're in California. They have a lot of choices. Another big company, I don't want to get it wrong, is, no, I better not, because I'll probably get the name wrong. But yeah, there are lots of companies that will sell mounts like that. But Celestron, C-E-L-E-S-T-R-O-N, they have a lot of choices, and they have a lot of choices from fairly small to very large. So that would be a place to start looking.
What would one of those cost a GOTO? I mean, what would be the range?
If you got a really small basic one, you're talking $400 or $500. And if you want, if you're Elon Musk, just there is the sky's the limit, millions. But the ones built for amateurs from $500, and if you find a deal, maybe less. But no less than $400, I would think. You know, they may even offer them for less than that, but I would not suggest buying them, because if they're under that amount of money, then yes, you're going to get the GOTO, but it's going to come on a flimsy tripod with lots of plastic parts, and I just couldn't recommend doing that. So do your research and get something, and look at reviews, because people buy these and they check them out, and something to remember with a computer telescope is, any telescope is a delicate instrument, and if one part is weak, the whole thing is weak. And when you add a computer, that's one more thing that might be great, but it might not be. So look at reviews of whatever you're looking at.
And what do you recommend for binoculars?
I would recommend any pair that you already have to start with, but most astronomy people would say the numbers they have on them, 10 by 50. That means it magnifies 10 times, and the objective lenses, the big lenses on the outside of it, they're 50 millimeters across. That 50 millimeters brings in a lot of light. Many people have smaller ones, 7 by 35. That means they magnify 7 times, and their lens is 35 millimeters. But those 50 millimeter lenses bring in more than twice as much light as the 35 millimeter ones. So that's a recommendation a lot of people give. But the 7x35s, they will show you Jupiter's moons. They'll give you a better view. Oh, man, one thing I forgot to mention. The Milky Way is out and bright in the summer. And that's what binoculars are fantastic for, looking at the Milky Way and seeing its billions of stars.
And one final thing. Joanne emailed. She lives in the La Crosse area, or will be in the La Crosse area this weekend, looking for some good dark places for looking up.
Oh. Well, we have a public observatory halfway between Ettrick and Galesville, but if you wanted to see things and you were in the La Crosse area, if you can get to the south of La Crosse and get up into the Bluffy areas anywhere, you're going to have better views. The southern sky is where things rise, the planets come up and stuff. And if you don't have La Crosse with all of its light pollution bothering you, that's better. So if you can get south of La Crosse, that's great. Or come way up where I'm about a half hour north of La Crosse. If she got hold of me, I'd be happy to take, I'm always happy to take people out to that observatory. There's a locked gate on the, it's in the school forest. But I know the chances of that are small, but it's just funny that you mentioned that, because I do take people out there. And we have a couple of big scopes out there, and we're always happy to share the night view.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Paul. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. We'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you.
All right. I love to share.
Paul Kinzer. He is the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. It's a great book. I think it's published by Harvard Press. Well, we've been looking up. Now we're going to take a look down and talk with you a little bit about geology and rocks. That next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.